This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Americans are big on adoption. Collectively, American couples adopt more children every year than the rest of the world combined.
Frequently, U.S. couples look overseas for children. Others look domestically. The process can be laborious either way.
And once a child comes home, the challenges can continue. That's especially true if the adopted child and parents are not of the same race.
Our next two guests, in fact, are two women who more than 20 years ago adopted two boys. The women are white. Their sons are black. They were born in Texas. With me in the studio is one of the mothers of the boys, Marlene Fine. She's co-author of a new book called The Interracial Adoption Option. And joining us by phone from Worcester, Massachusetts, is Marlene's spouse, Fern Johnson, who co-authored the book as well. Good to have you both on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, Marlene, you first. Let's start with the story. How did you make the decision, and Fern, you should feel free to pipe in when you like, how did you make the decision to adopt two boys, and two boys who were not the same race as you both?
Well, it's a long story, so I'll try to shorten it. We had made the decision to adopt. It was 1988 when we decided to adopt. And at that point, gay men and lesbians could not adopt in the state of Massachusetts. So we were pursuing adoption as single women. And that restricted our options. So as singles, we had not very many options available to us. So we started to look at a variety of countries where we thought we might be able to adopt. And there were a number of issues that came up. So, for example, at that time, if we were to adopt, well, we couldn't adopt from Korea. You had to be married. We couldn't adopt from the Philippines. You had to be married and you had to be Catholic. We couldn't adopt, or we chose not to adopt from India. We did some research and discovered that a lot of the babies there were born with cerebral palsy because they were forceps children. In Peru, we had to go live there for 6 months.
So had it ever occurred to you to adopt two African-American boys?
Well, it actually had occurred to us to do that. But at that time, the National Association of Black Social Workers had a very strong statement opposing the adoption of black children by whites. And we decided to defer to that position.
Which said that interracial adoption was unnatural, artificial, and unnecessary. Actually, Marlene, let me bring Fern in here
yes.
for a second. Tell me more, Fern, about this decision that you actively pursued to adopt two African-American boys.
Yes, this was an interesting transition for us. We were going through the process of our home study. I was attending as a single person who had applied to adopt a child. My adoption sessions, and many of them were focused on international. One of the sessions, a social worker came in to talk about their domestic adoption program, and she was talking about the adoption of black children. Very aware, of course, of the position of the Association of Black Social Workers, but she started to present statistics about the number of children in foster care, the disproportionate number of those children being black or biracial at the time. And she absolutely said, you need to be comfortable with what you're doing, but if you think as a white person that all these children of color are going to be matched racially to an adoptive family, that's not going to happen. That, you know, the odds are that a large number of them will remain in foster care. That was really a transformative experience and led the two of us to think very differently about adopting a child of color. Once we had decided that we would, then our social worker said, if you have no preference one way or the other, the likelihood is that you will be adopting a black boy because of the sheer numbers of black males that were in the foster system at the time. That would still be the case today.
And many more black males than black females.
Many more black males than black females.
So how did the actual adoption process happen?
It happened very fast. Once we completed our home study and the application went forward, once we said that we were open to adopting a black child domestically and that we didn't care about the gender, within 4 months we had a baby placed with us.
Within 4 months?
4 months.
How old was he?
4 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what happened with the second?
With the second one, we also got the placement much faster than we planned on, so that we put our paperwork through so that the timing was such I was going to have a sabbatical and then Fern was going to take time off for the second child.
You're both in education.
We're both professors. I'm at Simmons. Fern is at Clark. And I went on sabbatical, and a couple weeks later, we got a call saying, oh, we have a placement for you. So there went my sabbatical.
Well, there went your sabbatical, and then, you know, there came in many, many changes in both of your lives. I want to talk about those, and I also want to give a shout out to listeners because we'd like to hear from you as well. Have you yourselves dealt at all with interracial adoption? And does Fern and Marlene, what they're saying right now, does it ring true with you, or perhaps you have had a different experience? Join our conversation. The phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So yours is not a traditional nuclear family, Marlene and Fern. You are not the least bit boring two women who are married to each other with two children from a different race from yours. How old are the boys right now?
24 and 22, actually almost 23 and 25.
So adult kids. I want to ask them, you about them and their lives in just a few minutes. But what was it that you realized? How soon did you realize that your lives might be different, and this is what the book is about, than you thought?
Well, I think almost immediately when we made the decision to adopt an African-American child, we immediately began to contact friends and family. And my parents, who had been extremely supportive of our adopting a child from overseas, when I called my mother to tell her, her immediate reaction was, "We're making a mistake. Birds of a feather should flock together." And I was stunned by her reaction because I grew up in a family that I thought was very open, very liberal, and I thought they'd be very welcoming of a child of color into the family. So I remember gathering my wits and saying, "Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but Fern and I really hope that you and Dad want to be grandparents to these children because we're going to have them." They adore their grandchildren. Well, my father's gone now, but my mother and father were in love with them from the moment they saw their pictures.
Fern, do you remember how the issue of race first arose in your family in ways that perhaps surprised even you?
Yeah, my own family, you know, was very supportive because the barrier had already been crossed by both of my siblings in their marriages, one to a Chinese Hawaiian and one to a Korean woman. But when our child was an infant, I was at a professional dinner talking to a woman who was sitting next to me who I didn't know very well. And she was, you know, very, very interested. She'd been told that, you know, we'd adopted a child, and I told her that the child was African-American, or this came up. And her first question to me was, "Is he dark?" And, it caught me completely off balance because that's not the question I thought she was going to ask me. I was asked that question a number of times, that, you know, that somehow there was this idea that, you know, if you were a white person and you were adopting, a child who was, you know, labeled black or African American, that of course you would be trying to adopt a child who wasn't very dark. I thought that was really, startling given the time that we were in then, in, you know, the early 1990s.
I wonder if either of you startled yourselves or maybe each other with something that you thought that challenged your own concept of how you would deal with issues of race.
I don't know that I can identify something in particular that challenged us. I think that we were both startled by how little most white people know about the experiences of people of color and how little we knew about race and those experiences.
What's an example?
For example, one of the things that I often teach in my classes is the concept of white privilege. And so it's a concept I know forwards and backwards, and I felt like I really knew it. And when our older son was, when the adoption papers went through, he was still a baby, I went down to get his Social Security papers and or Social Security card. And when I went down to wait in the office for the card, I was dressed very casually in jeans. I had a black baby with me. And when my name is called, I go up to the desk and the woman says to me, "Oh, are you here for your monthly welfare check?" And I just stood there, you know, like, no, I'm not. But it was such a shock to me, such a visceral reaction on my part. And I began to understand that I really didn't know all of these experiences that blacks in the United States have every day of their lives.
Suddenly, as you write, you both became part of an interracial family. How did that change your home, your dinner time discussions? How did it change anything, Fern?
Well, we certainly, you know, tried to do things in our home that would reflect the people who live there, and became very conscious very quickly, you know, when our children were infants, that there was virtually nothing in our house that would suggest that anybody who was African American lived there. You know, whether these were objects of art, whether they were just, you know, small things that you might have around the house. And that we also knew that when we went into the homes of African American friends, that their houses didn't look like that. So, you know, it's not like you go out and decorate your house, but you become more sensitive to the images, you know, that are there. You know, little things, certainly for, you know, little children, you know, you know, books and toys. That's a big issue, trying to find toys, trying to find an ornament for the Christmas tree that has, you know, a figure of a black person. You never really think of Christmas tree ornaments as racialized, but they are. You know, the drummer boys are white, and, you know, the little cute little kids on sleds that you might find are white. And, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to find things that were different from that in terms of our home. In terms of our conversations, you know, one thing that struck me very early on was that, you know, some black friends said, well, one of the differences between dinner conversation in a white home and a black home was that in a black home, you talked about race around the dinner table every night. It just came up. It's a natural thing. That certainly was not the case for us as white people. We didn't talk about race every night.
Did your kids?
Well, before we had kids, we didn't. Once we had kids, when something came up, you know, we really made an effort to make sure. And it was an effort initially, because you have to jar your whole way of, you know, conversing. So to comment on something that might have happened in the world, or to ask them something about school, if there was a child in some, you know, event or something who was African American or Chinese American, you know, to ask them if they knew the child, or if there was anybody else, you know, in their group who was not white, but just to make sure that the conversational, you know, oil was flowing in a way.
Right. You wanted to be.
The topic could always come up.
Yeah.
So, you know, hoping that if they had something to say, that they would say it.
That they knew they could say it. I want to turn to a couple of phone calls now very briefly. Alana from Cambridge on line 5. Tell us about your experience.
Hi. I was adopted by two white lesbian mothers, and I am an African-American woman, 22. And I have, you know, my views on sort of race and my racial identity have sort of, you know, morphed over the years. I feel like while I have both white and black friends, I do identify, you know, I guess I would say I'm African-American, but culturally identify more with my white friends because, you know, the experiences of growing up in a white neighborhood were so different than my friends that maybe who grew up in a black neighborhood. And I was just wondering for the two we have on today, if their sons, how they identify.
Oh, I think that's a wonderful comment, and I think they would say exactly what you said. In fact, our older son, in a paper he recently wrote for a class on race, talked about having a very, very strong African-American identity, but feeling as if he had been socialized as a white growing up in white communities. We had made the decision early on that the most important thing for us in choosing a community to live in was the quality of education. And so we wanted the boys to be in towns where they had access to high quality education. But that did mean that they were growing up in communities that were primarily white. And I do know that that means you're always negotiating your identity in very difficult ways.
Fern, do you think it would have been different, and this is speculative, but I'm responding to one call we have from a woman in Framingham who is an adoptive parent of one white child and one Latina. Do you think it would have been different if your children were not African-American, but maybe Asian or Latino?
Well, it definitely would have been different, but different only in the sense that there are different experiences. You know, for example, both Marlene and I always felt that, you know, we need to be vigilant about the kind of expectations that teachers had of our, you know, young black sons, the kind of this notion that they have lower expectations. It's actually been written about by educators. You know, and if they behave and, you know, they're not disruptive and they're doing good enough, that's okay. And, you know, we did feel a number of times that they needed to be pushed a little bit more. On the other hand, if you're a white parent and you're the parent of, a Chinese-American child, for example, there's a stereotype in the other direction, which is, of course, that, you know, this child is going to be the model student and this child is going to excel in, you know, math and science, and you know, maybe the child isn't, you know, inclined in those particular directions.
Are you? Let me just to follow up here. Just ask you both: how do your sons feel about the book?
I think they are really proud and happy. When we told them we were going to be on Radio Boston, they had huge grins on their faces.
They may be listening.
Yes. Oh, well, they posted it on Facebook to
all
tell
right,
their
guys.
Friends
I
to
didn't
listen.
I hear them calling in, but that's all right. All right. Well, thank you so much, both of you. Marlene Fine, co-author of the new book, The Interracial Adoption Option, and Marlene's spouse, Fern Johnson, co-authored the book as well. She joined us by phone from Worcester. She teaches English at Clark University. Marlene Fine teaches communications at Simmons College. So nice to have you both here.
Thank you so
us.
Much.
Stay with us. Up next, musician Meg Hutchinson live in our studio. I'm Lisa Mullins with Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.